Okay, very good. So let us continue on the suttas. And just to remind you what's going on, we have been looking before at the Satipatthana, and one of the things that I wanted to do was to look at the things that support the meditation practice or Satipatthana practice. So this morning we looked at how to purify your mind from ill will in particular, and how to move from ill will gradually over to metta. And if you, the more metta you have, the easier meditation is going to be. It's going to be a very powerful supporting condition for meditation practice. But what is one of the other interesting points about meditation practice and Satipatthana in particular is that it is also supported by your outlook. How you look at the world, how you think about life, what is important to you. Outlook, it's called Ujjukaditti in the Satipatthana Sanghita. It means like straight view. And the reason why this matters so much is because your outlook, how you look at the world, how you think about things, that is what gives you your values. That is what is important to you. That is what is significant. That is where you spend, where your mind kind of hangs out with. Yeah, those things that are valuable to you. So if you find value in certain things, your mind will go there. If you find value in other things, like meditation practice, your mind will go to the meditation practice. And it's so much easier to meditate when you have the right kind of values than if your values are in the wrong place. So most of you will already have pretty good values. Yeah, that's why you're here. Otherwise you wouldn't be here. So you already are on the right track. But we need to strengthen that outlook to make it even stronger, to make meditation practice even easier. So this next sutta is about a particular way of looking at the world. And it concerns in particular things like the sensual objects of the world, the sensual pleasures of the world. So it helps you to overcome some of the attachment to the sensual things and then move towards more the spiritual things instead. That is kind of the idea behind the sutta. So it is both good for overcoming sensuality to some extent, but also useful for outlook. It's basically, these are two sides of the same coin really. And this next sutta is called the Potalya Sutta. It's another sutta that I usually read out on these retreats because I think it is quite a useful one. It is really a number of similes about how to think about sensuality and the spiritual life and how they compare. That's really what it is about. So this is how it goes. Householder, suppose a dog overcome by hunger and weakness was waiting by a butcher's shop. Then a skilled butcher or his apprentice would toss the dog a well-hacked, clean-hacked skeleton of meatless bones smeared with blood. What do you think, householder? Would that dog get rid of his hunger and weakness by gnawing such a well-hacked, clean-hacked skeleton of meatless bones smeared with blood? No, venerable sir. Why is that? Because that was a skeleton of well-hacked, clean-hacked, meatless bones smeared with blood. Eventually, that dog would reap weariness and disappointment. So too, householder, a noble disciple considers thus. Sensual pleasures have been compared to a skeleton by the Blessed One. They provide much suffering and much despair, while the danger in them is great. Having seen this as it actually is with proper wisdom. And then it goes on to something about equanimity. So it kind of, in other words, it evens out your mind when you see these things. Yeah, you have a sense of equanimity. I'm not going to go on to that because that's taking us a little bit far away from the purpose of this. So the point here, the Buddha is comparing sensual pleasures in the world to a skeleton, yeah, a meatless skeleton, that's what he's saying here. And first of all, when we talk about sensual pleasures, these are kama in Pali, it means two different things. Sensual pleasures, on the one hand, is like the desire inside of you for sensual things, yeah, like food or whatever it is. That is one aspect of it. But the other aspect of karma is actually the very object that we desire outside. That's also included in sensual pleasures. So what the Buddha is talking about here is all the things in the world that we would like to a mass that we like to acquire so as to be able to live what we think is a satisfying life as a consequence. So the sensual objects in the world and also the sensual desire, these are two things that kind of revolve around each other. And what the Buddha is saying here, what the simile of the dog is saying, is that this dog is always running from one butcher shop to another one. It runs to one butcher shop, hoping that the butcher will give him a nice piece of meat. That's what the dog is hoping. It never learns the lesson. The butcher never gives nice meat to a dog. This is otherwise a very stupid butcher. Maybe not stupid, maybe kind and compassionate, but most butchers are more into money than into being kind to stray dogs. So the butcher goes to the butcher shop, and then of course he gets this bone, and on this bone all that's left is a bit of blood. So kind of the dog gets the taste, gets a taste of blood, it kind of tastes nice, but there's no satisfaction there, there's no completion, there's no sense of actually getting any sustenance. So after kind of licking off the blood, then the dog runs off to the next butcher shop. Hasn't learned anything. Next butcher, of course, exactly the same as the previous one. In this simile, all butchers are exactly the same. And again, gets this skeleton and bones smeared with blood. That's all this butcher gets when he goes to the next butcher shop. And then it carries on like that, running on and on and on, never learning a lesson. Then the dog dies, and in his next life he gets reborn as a dog, because once you get stuck as a dog, it lasts a long time, and you continue running on after new butchers in your next life. Maybe you get reborn in a different country, different kind of butcher in a different country, and then you kind of, but butchers are still the same regardless of which country they live in. Numbers make any difference. And it's exactly the same when you run after sensual pleasures. When running after sensual pleasures, it doesn't really give any real satisfaction. You get something in your life, you have a meal, and before you know it, you have to have another meal. And you keep on running after these meals all the time. Or you run after relationships, you have one relationship. It doesn't really satisfy you. It doesn't really get you anywhere. You get a new car, you're really happy with the car for a couple of weeks. And then gradually the desire for a new car starts to arise again. You get a house you're very happy with, whatever it is. There's always new sensual pleasures to look forward to somewhere in the future. You always keep running after new things. There's never any final satisfaction. But then you die. And then after you die, you get reborn. And when you get reborn, you still have that craving, it's still inside of you. So you continue running after sensual pleasures. And this, it goes on and on and on. And you never find that thing that you're looking for. If you look at the craving inside of you, the craving usually says something like, if you get this, you will be satisfied. That's what the craving says. If you look at what craving says, when you get into this relationship, I know I won't be 100% satisfied, but I'll be pretty satisfied in this relationship. That's what craving says every time. But actually, very often it is not the case. And even if it is the case, the relationship will break up and then you have to go on to another one. It is always like that. Craving never stops. You just keep on running and running, life after life after life. You've been doing the thing that you're doing now. We have been doing this already hundreds of lives before, thousands of lives before, millions of lives before. How many times are we going to do this? Is it that much fun to keep running around after all of these things? That we really want to do this again and again and again? After a while, you start to see how pointless it is. It doesn't get you anywhere. You're just going round and round and round, doing exactly the same thing, time and time again. There is no final point. There is no purpose to this. There is no aim. There is no goal. You're not actually going anywhere. The idea is that, to achieve some purpose. But this has no purpose. It is just doing the same thing over and over and over, endlessly. And this is the problem with sensual desire. This is why this is the one thing that ties us more to samsaric existence than anything else. Because there is continuous running on, always looking for something in the future. And that looking for something in the future, that craving, is the thing that binds you to samsara. It's like you're projecting yourself on from one life to the next one, again and again and again. Sensual desire is the number one enemy that ties us to rebirth and ties us to a future existence. On and on and on. And the problem is, and the reason why it doesn't work, is because, as I said yesterday, it is a psychological problem. It is a psychological lack of fulfillment that we have. There's something inside of us which is missing. And you cannot fill that psychological gap, that psychological hole. You cannot fill it with external things. Yeah, you cannot expect a wife or a husband or a friend or external phenomena to fill up something which is missing inside of you. It is not going to work. Yeah, that hole is still going to be there, and then you have to start from scratch again. So, what this means is that you have to find an alternative way of finding that satisfaction, not through external things, but by developing and changing your mind and your outlook. That is the right way of filling that hole, that incompleteness, that dissatisfaction inside. That is how you have to do it. And you know already what that is. Yeah, you know all the spiritual things that you have to develop. You develop kindness, you develop generosity and all of these things. And when you are kind to someone else, you will notice that that happiness that you get from kindness is a different kind of happiness from the happiness of sensual objects in the world. And the difference is that happiness that comes through kindness is a happiness that gives you happiness right here and right now. It has nothing to do with craving. You feel satisfied. It satisfies you, that kind of happiness. It is a joy in the present moment. It is not something about the future, something that you're always running after. That is the difference. And then you develop that happiness. You develop it, first of all, through your virtue, your morality, your sila. Then you take that sila into your meditation practice, and you develop it by focusing on the breath or whatever. And the joy and the happiness increases and increases. And as the joy and happiness increases, the craving goes down in proportion. Craving becomes less and less and less. The mind becomes more and more still, less and less movement. Until one day you enter a state of samadhi for the very first time. And when you enter that state of samadhi, which is extraordinarily blissful, absolutely still, all craving is gone. For the first time in your life, you realize that you have found the thing that you were looking for all along. This is what you were looking for when you were running after all these objects. This is what the craving was telling you. This is what you will get if you follow the craving. But craving can never give you that. Instead, you find it in a completely different place by practicing the spiritual path. One day, when you get to samadhi, you actually have found that very thing that you were looking for. You have discovered the answer to the question of the meaning of life. You know this is it. This is what it's all about. Yeah, and this is actually the power of the meditation practice, of living the spiritual life the right way. It gets you exactly where you want to be. It's extraordinarily powerful. Yeah, it's just absolutely astonishing that this is possible. And then, of course, beyond that, samadhi is not enough, because then it disappears again. So you also need the insight on top of that. So then comes the insight, and then you stabilize everything. And then you can you actually find a permanent solution to the answer to the meaning of life. No more running around. No more empty promises. Yeah, the real satisfaction, real completion, that hole inside of you, that itch that is never satisfied, suddenly it is gone. No more desire. What does it mean not to have any more desire? What it means is that you just sit here, you don't want to do anything else. Sounds boring, but actually it's not boring at all. It's incredibly satisfying because you're satisfied. Yeah, it's kind of... I hope that makes sense to you. But that's basically what it is. Yeah, you just sit back and you are absolutely happy. When there's no more craving, by definition, you have found the answer to what you were looking for all along. And you are so happy and content. So that is the simile of the dog. Yeah, and this is the first simile of the Buddha. And it shows you in very stark contrast the difference between the worldly happiness and the spiritual happiness. And it starts, once you start to get this, it changes your outlook, your values, and the purpose and the aim in life. Let's go on to the next one here. Okay, so householders, suppose a vulture A heron or a hawk seized a piece of meat and flew away. And then other vultures, other herons and hawks, they pursued it and pecked and clawed it. What do you think, our soldier, if that vulture, heron or hawk does not quickly let go of that piece of meat, wouldn't it incur death or deadly suffering because of that? Yes, venerable sir, so too, householder, a noble disciple considers thus. Sensual pleasures have been compared to a piece of meat by the Blessed One. They provide much suffering and much despair, while the danger in them is great. So, here we have an alternative way of looking at the sensual objects of the world. So here you have this bird who has got a piece of meat, and of course again bird is very happy, gets a piece of meat, it's difficult to get hold of for birds, and so you fly off, and when you fly off with that piece of meat, other birds get jealous, they also want that piece of meat, so they fly after you and they try to rip that piece of meat out of your claws. And this is basically what happens in the human realm too. This is what happens with human beings. We finally get something that we like. Finally, we get into a nice relationship. We get a nice husband or nice wife. And then somebody else wants exactly the same husband and same wife. And then we start to be fearful. Yeah, someone else might take them away from us. You know what it's like? This is exactly what it's like, yes? Those things that are pleasurable in the world, there's a limited supply of nice husbands and nice wives. Because there's a limited supply, we fight over that supply. Yeah, this is the problem. And not just husbands and wives, but there is a limited resources in general. Not everyone can be as wealthy as, what is the most wealthy person right now in the world? Jeff Bezos or something like that? The Amazon is probably one of the most wealthy ones, yeah? So not everyone can be that wealthy, because if that happens, the economy crashes. We can't provide for everyone in that way. So there's always going to be a fight over resources. Yeah, there's always going to be one country is going to fight with another one. You have the Gulf War. We're trying to get oil for our country. Yeah, because oil is a limited resource. So we want to make sure we have enough in our country. Yeah. There's a nice simile in one of the suttas it's one of the monks is talking to a king, and he says to this king, he already has a large country, yeah, lots of gold and lots of elephants, and he has everything, this particular king. And then this monk says to this king, well, you know, if one of your men, he came to you from the east and says to you, well, there's a large kingdom in the east, you know, lots of gold, lots of money, lots of elephant, lots of horses, lots of everything, but its army is weaker than yours. What would you do? Oh, I would conquer it, of course. And another man comes from the north and says exactly the same thing. What would you do? Oh, I would conquer that one too. If you come from the west, what would you do? I would conquer that one too. And on it goes. Yeah, a king is never satisfied with the country he or she has. So you keep on conquering more territories and you are never satisfied. And this shows you the problem with craving. It is not rational, it's completely irrational. It doesn't matter what, you can never enjoy all that land, you can never enjoy all that gold. It's just an idea in your head. But that idea in your head is so powerful that it kind of keeps you running and running after things. And this is how wars start, because if you want another country, there's going to be a problem. Or it happens on a personal level. Yeah, we have, when we are children, perhaps we fight over a piece of cake or something silly like that, or a toy. When we become adults, we fight in the corporate hierarchy to climb the corporate ladder. And then we do dodgy things on the way to make sure we make our way up faster than other people. Yeah, or we fight over the inheritance when our last generation passes away. We fight over the inheritance. And one of the things that I've always said, the larger the inheritance, the more they fight. It's crazy. The larger the inheritance, there should be enough to go around for everyone, but the more money there is, the more they fight over it. That's usually how things work, unless you are wise, in which case you don't fight over these things. So this is the problem, yeah? These things, the sensual objects of the world, are always limited, so we always fight over these things. But the spiritual happiness is different. The spiritual happiness is a personal happiness inside of you. It is not something that you can fight over with other people. because it is personal to yourself. It is inside of you. In fact, it has the opposite effect. Because if you pursue that spiritual happiness, it is a happiness that leads to harmony. You want to live in harmony with people because that inner happiness you have depends on your external harmony. Yes, so it has the exact opposite effect. It leads to a better world, a more harmonious world, less fighting over resources, less fighting over the external things. Yeah, it's like a monk, a nun, or nun is not going to fight with you over your husband or wife. Yeah, usually anyways, hopefully not. Yeah, so it is more safe, it is better, and that is the good thing. It's a completely different way of looking at things. And this is a very interesting thing, because what this means is that with the sensual pleasures, always comes competition, comes violence, comes problems, comes conflict. Yeah, it always arises out of sensual pleasures. It is inherent to sensual pleasures. That is kind of very off-putting, isn't it? Once you understand that if you are going to pursue sensual pleasures in your life, you are also pursuing conflict and problems, because the two always have to go hand in hand. Isn't that kind of unpleasant? It turns you away from these pleasures, because you know that they are impure by their very nature, and they lead to all kinds of problems as a consequence. Okay. So that is the simile of the piece of meat and the hawks and the herons fighting over that piece of meat. Then we have the next one. Householders, suppose a man took a blazing grass torch and went against the wind. What do you think, householder, if that man does not quickly let go of that blazing grass torch, wouldn't that blazing grass torch burn his hand or his arm or some other part of his body, so that he might incur death, or not really deadly suffering, more like death-like suffering is a better translation, death-like suffering because of that? Yes, venerable sir. So too, householder, a noble disciple considers thus. Sensual pleasures have been compared to a grass torch by the Blessed One. They provide much suffering and much despair, while the danger in them is great. So, sensual pleasures are like a grass torch. What does that mean? And it means that when you have a grass torch, yeah, you know what a grass torch is? It's like the kind of this kind of thing which you light on top, and it's made of grass. And with a grass torch, you first of all you grasp it, you cling to it, you attach to it. Yeah, and that is kind of the attachment, similar to the attachment to sensual pleasures, similar kind of idea. Now that grass torch, it gives you some pleasure because you can see. Yeah, if it's dark, you can actually see something. So there's some amount of happiness or pleasure, if you like, that comes from that. It is useful to some extent. But because it is a grass torch, and you go against the wind, the embers come off very quickly. And before you know it, embers blow onto you, and then your clothes start to burn or something like that. Yeah, so it is problematic. It causes problems. And sensual pleasures are similar in a way, because as soon as you pick up a sensual pleasure, as soon as you attach to something, because that is what sensual pleasures are about, we attach to things. Yeah, you know what I mean? If someone comes and wants to steal from you, what do you say? You say, no, thank you, please leave, it's my stuff. Yeah, you don't say, yeah, please take it, you know, whatever. That is because of attachment. Yeah, that's what it is, basically. So there's always attachment there with sensual pleasures. As soon as you pick something up, as soon as you acquire something, some degree of attachment occurs straight away. And as soon as you attach, you're asking for trouble. Why? Because anything you attach to, well, first of all, you will have a little bit of fear that you're going to lose it. Yeah, a little bit of fear. You're always going to look out for it. That little bit of fear is already a problem. And down the line, at some point, it will have to go. Yeah, everything we own will have to go at some stage in our life. At the very latest, when you pass away, when you die, it will have to go. And then, if you are very attached, you will have the suffering that comes from that attachment. This is one of the reasons why dying can be so difficult. This is one of the reasons why a little bit of death contemplation can be useful, because it can kind of get you used to the idea of letting go of things. And it can be very beautiful if you can do it in the right way. So don't hold too hard onto that grass torch, because it will lead to death or death-like suffering as a consequence. Now comes a really powerful simile. Householders suppose they were a charcoal pit deeper than a man's height, full of glowing coals without flame or smoke. Then a man came who wanted to live and not to die, who wanted pleasure and recoiled from pain. And two strong men seized him by both arms and dragged him towards that charcoal pit. What do you think, householder? Would that man twist his body this way and that? Yes, venerable sir, why is that? Because that man knows that if he falls into that charcoal pit, he will incur death or death-like suffering because of that. So too, householder, a noble disciple considers thus. Sensual pleasures have been compared to a charcoal pit by the Blessed One. They provide much suffering and much despair, while the danger in them is great. That is really quite challenging, isn't it? Sensual pleasures are like a charcoal pit. And as so often, the purpose of these similes is to reflect on them, yeah, and to think whether the Buddha has a point or not. The purpose is not just to say yes or no, I agree, I don't agree. That's not the purpose. So they're really meant there to reflect on them. But because it is the word of the Buddha, it is kind of useful to think about it a little bit and see if there might be a point to this. How is this possible? How can sensual pleasures be like a charcoal pit? How can your beautiful new car be a charcoal pit? How can that new relationship perhaps be like a charcoal pit? How is that possible? How can we look at this in a way that actually makes sense of this? And the way the Buddha describes this, and he describes it in another sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya called the Magandhya Sutta, is number 75, if you wish to look it up in the Majjhima Nikaya. And in the Magandhya Sutta, the Buddha says that it is like a leper. I teach this every time I'm here in Hong Kong. Often. I teach it everywhere, actually, because it's kind of powerful. So you may remember this, but he says that it's like a leper. If you are a leper, you have all these sores over your body. Yeah, leprosy is not very common in the world anymore, but it exists in certain places, like I think in India there are certain places there's still a bit of leprosy around. And you have all these sores on your hand because of the bacteria that causes leprosy. And what the lepers do, their sores, they itch so badly, it's terribly, terribly itchy. That what they do, they go to a charcoal pit and they put their hands or their feet over the charcoal pit and they burn themselves, cauterize themselves to get rid of that itch. That is how bad it is. Yes, you voluntarily burn yourself just to get rid of the itch. And then the Buddha says, well, suppose that leper, he found a doctor. It's quite easy to cure leprosy, apparently. So you find a doctor who cures you. And then the Buddha asks Magandhya, he asks him, well, if that leper was cured, would he still go back to that charcoal pit and burn himself afterwards? Of course not. Of course he wouldn't. Nobody's voluntarily going to burn yourself over a charcoal pit. And then the Buddha asks Magandhya, is it only now that charcoal pit is painful and hot and burning? Or was it also painful, hot and burning before, when he was burning himself? And Magandhya replies, it was hot on both occasions. But on the prior occasion, when he had leprosy, his faculties were distorted. He wasn't able to see clearly. And because he wasn't able to see clearly, he thought that what is actually painful is pleasurable. He thought there was pleasure in something that actually is painful. Yeah, and then the Buddha replies, well, so too, he says, this is exactly what it's like with sensual pleasures. It appears happy, it appears pleasurable, when actually it is painful. Yeah, this is what the Buddha says about this. So we have to investigate this. How is this possible? And the reason it is possible, and I will give you a simile to explain this. It doesn't apply perhaps to all sensual pleasures, but it happens in certain instances, in particular if there is a lot of craving involved. It is a craving which really makes the simile work. And the way to understand this is to think about smoking. Have anyone here ever smoked before? Yeah. Okay. When I was young, I admit, occasionally I would smoke a cigarette. Yeah. And I was never a regular smoker, but just occasionally I smoked a cigarette because I was young and foolish. And I remember it was terrible. Yeah, it was absolutely you coughing away and smoking, trying to be cool or something like that, and smoking the cigarette was absolutely nasty. Yeah, you feel like you're filling your lungs with poison. That's what it feels like when you smoke a cigarette. And it is really terrible. But then you see people who get addicted to cigarette smoking, and they love it. Yeah, wow, finally a cigarette. And they're so happy getting that cigarette. Yeah, because... So what's the difference? Is it suddenly the cigarette has turned into something beautiful and nice? Now it tastes like ice cream, but before it tasted like tar? Or is there something else going on? And what is going on there is that it is the craving that is the whole difference. The craving for the nicotine is so powerful and so strong that it turns what actually is an unpleasant thing into something pleasant. It appears pleasant, but actually it is unpleasant, just like it was before. That is the power of craving. Power of craving is to turn something around the other way. Huh? It is exactly the same thing with sensual pleasures. Yeah? If the craving is very strong, then something which actually inherently may be painful actually turns out to be pleasurable instead. This is especially when craving is very powerful. So investigate that. And I know that what is interesting is that there has been some experiments done in the modern times where they have looked at people's brains, yeah, and they've actually found that they thought that the pleasure aspect of the brain should light up. Yeah, but actually it didn't. It was actually the pain center that lighted up. People should be experiencing pleasure, but actually they weren't. It was painful instead. And there is a distortion there going on in the mind that is actually happening here. It's very fascinating because that modern experiment actually fits with how the Buddha looked at these things. So very fascinating. So how come, you know, we are basically trapped in a sense, and we are trapped in this false perception of reality. That is what the Buddha is saying here. So think about that. It is a very challenging idea, but think about the cigarette and you will kind of get some idea of what is happening there. Anyway, let us go on to the next one. Okay, householder, suppose a man dreamt about lovely parks, lovely groves, lovely meadows and lovely lakes, and on waking he saw nothing of it. So too, householder, a noble disciple considers thus. Sensual pleasures have been compared to a dream by the Blessed One. They provide much suffering and much despair, while the danger in them is great. Having seen this thus, as it actually is with proper wisdom, etc., etc. So, sensual pleasures are like a dream. This is another interesting one. It's almost as if they're not real. Yeah, they are kind of a dream. And a lot of the time, if you think about it, it kind of makes sense. So much of sensuality is about the future. It's about where you want to be, where you want to go. I want to get that relationship. I want to get this kind of house. I want to enjoy this kind of holiday. Always about something in the future. Yeah. When I was young, I thought about myself, my own career. I thought, I'm going to become like this, have this kind of career. I'm going to have this kind of girlfriend. Yeah. And now look what happened to me, yeah? That was a big mistake, yeah? It was a dream, absolutely no reality whatsoever. It's a complete illusion, basically. I ended up in a completely wrong place. It was a complete waste of time. And a lot of the time, that is exactly what happens, yeah? We dream about these things, and it's actually completely unrealistic. It's not going to be like that. And then instead of learning from that, we just change our dreams. We kind of downgrade our dreams a little bit, especially when you're young. You tend to be a bit conceited about what you can do in the world. So we downgrade the dream a little bit. But you still keep on dreaming. And you keep on dreaming until the day you die. You're still dreaming when you die. Yeah, when you just think about, you see the people are never really ready to die. They always think, well, at least there's going to be a few more days. That's how people usually think. Yeah, and because there's always a few more days, there's always a little bit of dreaming going on about the future. And that craving, that dreaming, which carries you on into the future, is the thing which then drives you on into the next life. And the dreaming continues next time around. So this is sensuality. Far, the majority of it is about thinking about things, yeah? When you get it, you kind of get used to it very quickly. It's like when you eat your food. Have you not? If you notice very carefully when you eat, a lot of the time your mind is already on the next spoon or the next chopstick, yeah? While you're chewing one, but your mind is already on the next one. You're not even enjoying the one you're having now. Have you noticed that? If you notice with mindfulness when you eat, how easy it is to move on into the future. You're always, again, just dreaming about something rather than enjoying what you have now. And so much of life is about that. It's about this future state that never actually arises. Or all the possessions you have, you can enjoy a few of those possessions, but a lot of the possessions you have are just an idea in your mind most of the time. You know you have them, they kind of give you a kind of security, but it's like a dream in your mind, an idea stuck in your mind. The spiritual happiness is exactly the opposite. The spiritual happiness is not about the future, as I said before. It is an immediate happiness that you have in the present moment. It is not really a dream about the future. It is a present moment reality that you have now. It is much more real than any of these sensual pleasures. Spiritual happiness is tangible. It's now. You can feel it for yourself. There's another little sutta which I should have had in here, because it's a really nice sutta. I always like to refer to this one, and I'll just tell you very briefly what it is about. It's the Samiddhi Sutta, which I usually read out on retreats. And in the Samiddhi Sutta, there's a monk called Samiddhi, and this deva, yeah, this god comes to Samiddhi, and then this god, I think, not sure, maybe it's a female god, I'm not sure, because it creates more kind of interest if there's a male monk and then a female god. Yeah, it kind of makes more kind of tension, more drama, if you like. So this goddess, she comes to this monk, yeah, and she says to this monk, "You're wasting your time. Yeah, you are young, for goodness sake. Yeah, you are young, you are strong, you could enjoy yourself in the world. You know, all of these things are just there. You get yourself a wife, for goodness sake. What are you messing around being a monk for? You are foregoing all the pleasures that are immediately available, searching for some kind of nirvana in the future you have no idea about." Yeah, so she is saying that you are actually, right here and now, you have all these sensual pleasures you can have. Yeah, instead you're kind of going for this ideal about the future. And then Samiddhi, the monk, he replies, actually it's the other way around. It is the sensual pleasures that are about the future, and the spiritual happiness is right here and right now. Yeah, and sometimes I like to mess around. This was when I was giving a talk somewhere, and I talked about this story. And so I asked the audience, "What do you think? Who is right? The deva, the sensual pleasures are right now, and you are foregoing them as a monk? Or is the monk right that the spiritual happiness is here, and the sensual happiness is about the future?" And there was a young man on the front row that, "Yeah, the deva is right, the monk is wrong. Yeah, the sensual happiness is available right now." And the whole audience was kind of burst out in laughter, because it was very funny when that happened. But of course, it is actually the monk who is right. And the reason why the monk is right is precisely because of this dream thing. Sensual pleasures are always about something in the future, always about something you are moving towards. You are forever moving towards something, never actually really getting there, always craving more, always desiring more. It's endless. And after a while you realize it's a con job, it is not real. You are kind of being led around by this criminal, the criminal Mara has got you by the nose, leading you on and on and on, never actually delivering the goods, always moving towards something that doesn't exist. Yeah, this is what it is. Whereas the spiritual happiness, again, is actually in the present moment. If you sit down in your meditation, you get your meditation right, suddenly things click in the right way. Or you just act on the urge of being kind and being generous to somebody. Suddenly the happiness is there. The joy arises in your mind. It's available at any moment, as long as you get it right. It's always available if you get it right. And when it is available, it is in the present moment. Got nothing to do with craving here. So that is the simile of the dream, yeah? Life, to most people, is like a dream. It's like a blur, yeah? Life is like a blur. You're kind of rushing along, yeah? Then you die. Yeah? Then you get born again, rushing along, and then you die. Yeah? And then you're rushing along the rushing along, and somebody says, actually, there are these Buddhist teachings here. You say, whoop, stop, wait a minute. Yeah, and you read the word of the Buddha, and you stop rushing for a while. And if you get it, you may actually stop rushing once and for all. If you don't get it, you keep on rushing again. This is what life is like. Rushing along, filling the graves. This is one of the similes in the suttas. The Buddha says, all we're doing is rushing along, filling the graves. Maybe it's time to stop filling the graves. Have you had enough filling the graves? Have I had enough filling the graves? I think so. You know, there's enough of that already. There's a nice simile somewhere about the amount of bones that we have kind of left behind in our samsaric existence. I'm not going to go there now, but this kind of makes this very stark and clear. Anyway, let's go on to the next simile here. Householder, suppose a man borrowed goods on loan, a fancy carriage, a fine jeweled earrings, and proceeded and surrounded by those borrowed goods, he went to the marketplace. Then people seeing him would say, sirs, that is a rich man, that is how the rich enjoy their wealth. Then the owners, whenever they saw him, would take back their things. What do you think, householder? Would that be enough for that man to become dejected? Yes, venerable sir, why is that? Because the owners took back their things. So too, householder, a noble disciple considers thus. The sensual objects of the world have been compared to borrowed goods by the Blessed One. They provide much suffering and much despair, while the danger in them is great. And again, the idea that sensuality is like borrowed goods, all the objects, all the things that we think that we own in this life, yeah? You have a sense of ownership. But actually, remember, you don't really own any of this. You're just borrowing it. You only have it for a time, and then eventually it all has to go. Yeah, everything you own in this world, one day someone is going to come around, they're going to steal it from you, or it's going to get damaged in the typhoon. I heard you had a typhoon in Hong Kong. Jerry was telling me the trees were all falling over in downtown in Hong Kong. And it's going to come, something is going to take it away. What is that thing which takes it away? It's just nature. Nature comes and takes it away from you. Yeah, we know that that is true. Very often it happens in this life. Your wife or husband, they find someone else, or they die, or they get sick, or whatever, or you leave them, or who knows what happens. But at the very latest, it's always going to happen when you die. When you die, everything has to go. Everything has to be given back. Yeah, so imagine that you live your life, all you do is accumulate things in this life. You build up your bank account, you build up your property, you build up your relationships, you build up your ego, make a big ego, yeah? You build up all of these things. And then, when you come to the end of your life, you have to die. Everything has to go. Your ego is built up on your relationships in this life. Your wealth is built up on things that you have to give back. Yeah, your degrees, your social standing, whatever it is, all of that belongs to this world. Your relationships all belong to this world. If you have invested all your time, all your energy into things that belong to this world, then when this world comes to an end, when you die, you're going to feel empty-handed. You're going to feel like you have wasted your time. There's nothing to take with you into the future. You're going to feel, wow, this is terrible. I have to let go of everything. I have nothing anymore. I wasted my life. You're going to be on your deathbed. You're going to feel confused. You're going to feel despairing because there's nothing to bring with you into the future. It's a terrible way of dying. So instead of thinking like that, what you do, you start to have a different kind of perspective. You look upon life not as a single lifetime. This is why the idea of rebirth is so incredibly important. Because suddenly you expand your horizons out, and you take into account all the rebirths that you may be having in the future. And you ask yourself, how can I invest my life, my time, my energy, in such a way that I have something I can take with me into the future? That's how you start thinking. So when you die, you don't feel like you have wasted your time. You don't feel like you kind of get confused and paranoid because you haven't spent your time well. Very often, if all you're interested is in this world, Not only don't you do the good things to keep it going in the future, very often you do bad things, yeah, to get those worldly things. You take shortcuts, you cheat a little bit, you do all kind of stuff, and you feel really confused when you die, because not only are you going to lose everything, but you have made a worse mind for yourself as well. So once you have this big outlook, you change your investment strategy. Yeah, instead of investing everything in this life, you invest something, you invest in the long horizon instead, and you start to think of things in a very different way. So what does it mean to invest for the long term? What it means is to build up a beautiful mind in this life, a bright mind, a mind that is more happy. So when you die, you are more happy than when you were born. Okay, forget about it, you can't remember when you were born, but say when you were kind of, you know, reached a certain age and you knew about happiness or whatever, yeah? So you are better off when you die than when you started out in life. You feel more happy, more bright. You have built up good qualities inside of you. And then you know that you haven't wasted your life. You know you have spent it well. You know that you have something to take with you into the future. And then you can die peacefully because you have done your very best. So how do we do that? Does it mean that you have to renounce and become a monk or a nun straight away? It can mean that, yeah. And, you know, if that's what you want, we will help you out, of course. But I don't really expect that to happen. But what it means that it changes how we live our ordinary life. This is the most important thing. It is more about how we live than what we actually do. You don't have to become a monk or nun. Yeah, you can, but you don't have to. But if you don't do it, it changes how you live your life. It changes how you live with your family. It changes how you do your job. It changes how you deal with the people around you on a daily basis. You focus more on the spiritual qualities in your life. You focus more on the kindness, the compassion, the wisdom, the understanding of other people. And you focus less on the goals that belong to this life. You're not so concerned about whether you have success in terms of finances or whatever. You don't worry so much about that. You worry more about how you get there. You worry more about the process than the goals in this life. The process matters more to you. So it's nothing wrong with being, you know, having a good career and having success. It's perfectly fine. But it is how you have the success becomes more important than the actual success. So how do you get there? Instead of, you know, treating people harshly because you want success, you treat people with kindness. And if that means you have to forego promotion, it doesn't matter so much. If you have to forego the promotion, then you know that at the very least you have lived well, and you will still feel good about yourself. If you are the person who takes shortcuts and treats other people badly, and then you still don't get the promotion, then you have a double negative effect. Yeah, you don't get the promotion and you have treated people badly on the way. Boy, that is really painful. And if you do get the promotion, then you may get the promotion in the short term, but then you get a demotion when you die. Yeah, when you die, you go down instead because you did all those shortcuts in the meantime. So promotion in this life, demotion in the future life, you can choose which one is more important. Yeah, I wouldn't recommend the demotion after you die. That's really much more painful than the demotion in this life. So we change our entire outlook. And in my experience, the people who are most successful in this world are those people who have a degree of kindness and care, because other people don't feel afraid of them. Yeah, the people I know who have done really well for themselves, they've often been people who care for their employees, they look after others, and it kind of comes naturally. Other people trust them, they're willing to have them as teachers and as bosses because they know that they are doing the right thing. So this is how you change your way of looking at life. You don't change so much what you do, you change how you do it. It is how which is the most important thing in life, not the what. It doesn't matter what kind of occupation you have, even if you are a monk or a nun or a layperson. What matters is how you live the monastic life, how you live the lay life. Being a monk is no good if you don't live it well. Okay, so that is the simile of the borrowed goods, so you know how to invest things in the right way. Then we come to the last simile here. householders, suppose there were a dense grove not far from some village or town, within which there was a tree laden with fruit, but none of its fruit had fallen to the ground. Then a man came, needing fruit, seeking fruit, wandering in search of fruit, and he entered the grove and saw the tree laden with fruit. Then he thought, this tree is laden with fruit, but none of the fruit has fallen to the ground. I know how to climb a tree, so let me climb this tree, eat as much fruit as I want, and fill my bag. And he did so. Then a second man came, needing fruit, seeking fruit, wandering in search of fruit, and taking a sharp axe, he too entered the grove, and saw that tree laden with fruit. Then he thought, this tree is laden with fruit, but none of its fruit has fallen to the ground. I do not know how to climb a tree, so let me cut this tree down at its root, eat as much fruit as I want, and fill my bag. And he did so. What do you think, householder? If that first man who has climbed that tree doesn't come down quickly, when the tree falls, wouldn't he break his hand or foot or some other part of his body so that he might incur death or death-like suffering because of that? Yes, venerable sir. So too, householder, a noble disciple considers thus. Sensual pleasures have been compared to fruits on a tree by the Blessed One. They provide much suffering and much despair, while the danger in them is great. So you have here the forest grove. Forest grove is a bit like samsara. Yeah, you wander around looking for nice things in the world, and then when you finally find something nice, you find the tree, you climb the tree. It's like, you know, grasping on to those sensual objects. And then you go up into that tree and you start eating those fruit. Yeah, the mangoes or whatever it is, beautiful, nice, ripe mangoes. Yeah, I hope you like mangoes, otherwise it simply doesn't work. Yeah. So you go to all those beautiful mangoes and you kind of sit up in this tree and you're really indulging yourself. The problem with indulgence is that you lose your sense of perspective. Yeah, you kind of get intoxicated. It's like drinking alcohol if you indulge too much. Intoxication means that you're no longer able to see things clearly. So when danger arises, yeah, this other man comes along with the axe. He tries to cut down, he wants to cut down the tree. Then because you are intoxicated, you are lacking in awareness. You haven't got the sati, you haven't got the clear comprehension, the sampajanya, to know what is happening. You're just eating mangoes very happily on top of the tree. So because of that, you then incur death or death-like suffering because you are intoxicated. And this is the problem with sensual pleasures. They lead to a kind of intoxication. They lead you away from clarity. And you will probably notice that when your mind is clear, there is no desire there. There's no intoxication. Yeah, that is when your mind is clear. If your mind has desires, it's like you are intoxicated. You can't see what is in your best interest. You lose perspective. You can't see the reality of the world anymore. And this is the problem. And this is why we try to reduce this desire for the sensual things in the world, and we try to move towards the spiritual things instead. And there's a beautiful simile which Ajahn Brahm tells, but it also found in the suttas. And that simile shows you the alternative. Yeah, and this is the next sutta here. I'll just read it out very briefly because we're already running out of time. We started a bit late, so I'm kind of adding a couple of minutes. And this is this next thing here from the Danta Bhumi Sutta coming next. And this simile is as follows. Suppose Agivesana, this is the Buddha speaking to a fellow called Agivesana. Suppose there were a high mountain, not far from a village or town, and two friends would leave the village or town and approach the mountain hand in hand. Having reached it, one friend would remain below at the foot of the mountain, while the other would climb to the top. Then the friend who remained below at the foot of the mountain would say to the friend who stood on the top, "Well, friend, what do you see standing on top of the mountain?" And the other replied, "Standing on top of the mountain, friend, I see lovely parks, lovely groves, lovely meadows, and lovely ponds." Then the first friend would say, "It is impossible, friend. It cannot happen that while standing on top of the mountain, you should see lovely parks, lovely groves, lovely meadows, and lovely ponds." Then the other friend would come down to the foot of the mountain, take his friend by the arm and force him to climb to the top of that mountain. After giving him a few moments to catch his breath, he would ask, "Well, friend, standing on top of the mountain, what do you see?" And his friend would reply, he's a little bit embarrassed now probably, "Standing on top of the mountain, I see lovely parks, lovely groves, lovely meadows, and lovely ponds," feeling a bit sheepish. Then the other would say, "Well, friend, just a little earlier we heard you say, 'It is impossible, friend, it cannot happen, that while standing on top of the mountain you should see lovely parks and all these things.' But just now we heard you say, 'Standing here, I see lovely parks, and etc., and lovely ponds.'" Then the first friend would reply, "Because I was obstructed by this high mountain, friend. I did not see that what was there to be seen." And this simile is used to explain why people don't understand what samadhi is all about. It's specifically about samadhi experiences. And the thing here is that when you climbing the mountain is like a simile of getting above the jungle. In the previous simile, the two friends were wandering around the jungle. They come to the tree laden with fruit. And they are always in the jungle. They can't really see what is important. But to be able to understand reality properly, you have to elevate yourself out of that jungle. That is like climbing the mountain. And when you climb the mountain, you get the bird's eye view. Suddenly, you can see what is going on. This is what climbing the mountain is all about. Ajahn Brahm also gave the simile when he went on a holiday in Central America before he became a monk, which is a long time ago now, 50 years ago or something. And you climb up, and suddenly you get a different view of reality. Suddenly you understand what's going on, because you are above all of these things. You can see the ponds, the meadows, as it says here, the lakes, and all these kind of things, and you know what is happening. And it's exactly the same thing with our meditation practice. In ordinary life, we don't know that even samadhi is possible. You know, this like this fellow in the simile here, he didn't believe in samadhi. It's absolute rubbish, it's samadhi stuff. Yeah, sure, you can kind of go within yourself and find this kind of, you know, one-pointedness. That's what he's saying in there. I haven't actually taken that part of the sutta in there. But then, when you do withdraw from the world outside and you go inside of yourself, what you are doing is that you are elevating your mind above all the sensual things in the world. You're withdrawing from that. And then one day you're completely withdrawn. And when you're completely withdrawn, it's like you get the bird's eye view from far above. And suddenly you can understand what sensual pleasures are all about. This is the meaning of the simile here. You're like drawn up. Now you understand only when your mind has completely withdrawn from the jungle of sensual objects and desires is it possible to understand what sensuality is all about. Only then can you actually get this. And what is interesting about this simile is that, you know, when you are below, you are obstructed by this mountain, and this mountain is a simile for the five hindrances. Or is a simile for ignorance, for avidya. You don't know what's happening here. So to be able to do that, you need someone to guide you. You need a kalyanamita. You need a good friend. Who is that good friend? Well, in the simile, it's the guy who just grabs him by the arm and pulls him along. Okay, I'm going to show you. So sometimes the Buddha comes and he grabs you by the arm. And sometimes you may not be willing to do it because you think the Buddha is asking too much. But somehow, there's something very powerful about these teachings, something very compelling. It feels right, even though you're kind of resisting it a little bit. You know what I mean? It's kind of, the Dhamma is always like that. It is powerful and strong, but still we resist a little bit, because we are kind of in two minds about this. And then the Buddha is so persuasive, he pulls you to the top of the mountain. The Buddha is the Kalyanamita that makes it accessible also for you and draws you to the top. And then you see, and then when you see that, you bow down to the Buddha in a new way that you have never bowed down before, because you understand that he has given you the highest gift that any human being can possibly give you. This is why the Buddha is such a remarkable Kalyanamita. So this simile is about the importance of the Kalyanamita to be able to enable us to see things really as they actually are. And then you understand the limitations of all of these things. You get above, you get the bird's eye view, and you understand what life really is about and what really matters in this world. So, that is some of the similes about sensual pleasures and sensual desires and these things. And remember, the main purpose of reading these things out is just to help you to see the world in a slightly different way. Yeah? I'm sure you already have some awareness of this. I'm sure it makes sense to you to some extent. Otherwise, you probably wouldn't be here. But this is kind of to make that even more, a little bit more powerful. Because it takes a long time for the similes to really sink in. And as you do this, as they gradually sink in, you feel a gradual liberation of the mind. Your mind is getting more and more free. Yeah, and it's a very beautiful, it's a slow path, but a very beautiful path of liberating yourself from the constraints of the world and allowing you kind of yourself to flourish more in the Dhamma. So anyway, I shall stop there, and then we will continue with some more meditation and the Q&A this evening at 7 o'clock. So see you again at 7 o'clock. Yeah.